Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Garth Nix. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the winner of the Aurora Award for Best Fan-Related Work in 2019. My name is Edward Willett. I am your host, and I should mention also that The World Shapers is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, which is supported by Connexus Credit Union. I started The World Shapers because I am also a writer of science fiction and fantasy, and I've always enjoyed talking to other authors about how they create things. I will mention, as I usually do, my latest book, which is Master of the World. This is book two in a series called World Shapers, much like this podcast. The first book was World Shaper, came out last year. Master of the World carries on the story, and I'm currently working on the third book called The Moonlit World, which will be out next year. World Shapers takes place in a labyrinth of shaped worlds, and the shapers are people who have the ability to shape these worlds that are studded in the labyrinth, like, chocolate chips and a muffin, I guess. My main character, Shauna Keyes, lives in a world very much like ours. And in the first book, she discovers that, in fact, although she doesn't remember it, she actually shaped the world to be the way that it is. But an adversary, an enemy, has come into her world, has touched her during an attack that kills her best friend, and has stolen her knowledge of the making of her world, which means he can now start to unmake it or change the way that it works. And this puts her on the run in the company of Carl Yatzer, the mysterious stranger who shows up and explains all this to her. And he also says that she has the power, which she demonstrated during the attack, to possibly save all of the shaped worlds if she can travel from world to world and take their knowledge to the mysterious Agrair at the center of the labyrinth, the woman who opened up the labyrinth and trained the shapers in our world, the first world, and then put them into these worlds to do with as they please. So the first world, they get the first book, World Shaper, Shauna and Carl get chased across something that's somewhat like our world. In the second book, Master of the World, out now, Shauna ends up in a world shaped by someone with a great love of Jules Verne. So it's very steampunky with submarines and flying machines and floating islands and all that kind of good stuff. And in the third book, The Moonlit World, which I mentioned I'm working on now, the title in my head for a long time was actually Werewolves and Vampires and Peasants. Oh my. that's what you can look for when we get to book three of World Shapers, which will be out next year. And if you'd like to know more about my fiction, you can check out my website, which is edwardwillett.com, EdwardWillett.com. It's quite complete, and you can find out all about the, 20-some novels and all the nonfiction that I've written over the years. All right, that's enough about me. Let's move on to this episode's guest, Garth Nix. New York Times bestselling novelist Garth Nix has been a full-time writer since 2001, but has also worked as a literary agent, marketing consultant, book editor, book publicist, book sales representative, bookseller, a lot of books in there, and as a part-time soldier in the Australian Army Reserve. He has written numerous books, including the Old Kingdom series, beginning with Sabriel, the Keys to the Kingdom series, Frog Kisser, and many others. He also writes short fiction with more than 60 stories published in anthologies and magazines. More than 6 million copies of his books have been sold around the world, and his work has been translated into 42 languages. That's a lot. Welcome to The World Shapers, Garth.
Thank you, Edward. It's great to be talking to you.
We've only met once, I think, and that was at a world fantasy convention in Toronto. Well, actually, technically, I think it was in Richmond Hill, but you could see Toronto in the distance.
Yeah, you could see it very vaguely in the distance. It was a shock, I think, to quite a few international persons such as myself to discover that it was not quite in Toronto, being called Toronto. Yeah,
it's a bit of a shock to me, even though I live in Canada. I was expecting to be a little closer to downtown as well.
Well, I think we did have the misfortune that the railway was being worked on and the other public transport. So I think if everything had been up and running, it wouldn't have felt quite so far away. But of course, we were just talking about, you know, with World Fantasy, it doesn't really matter. You know, that convention is a, you know, a traveling community that pops up and you tend to spend all your time with all the other writers and publishers and editors and agents all hanging out anyway. So, you know, maybe it doesn't really matter so much.
It was still a fun convention, even.
It was great. Yeah, it was very good.
Though it wasn't right downtown. The other thing I always like to mention, you know, when I'm looking for connections, this is not exactly a connection with you, but I wrote a fantasy trilogy called Masks of Agrima as E.C. Blake. And some reviewers said that they liked my 15-year-old female protagonist. She was their favorite female heroine since Sabriel.
Oh, that's a nice thing to say. But that is a connection, yeah.
I consider that a great great compliment because I really loved those
thank
books.
You.
So,
Thank you.
We're going to start, as I always start with my guests, by taking you back in time. First of all, where did you grow up and all that sort of thing? But how did you become interested in writing and fantasy? And which came first? Were you interested in the fantastical and science fiction before you started writing, or did the writing come first and then you migrated into it? How did that all work out for you?
Sure, it's a good question. I grew up in Canberra, which is the federal capital of Australia. But it's still a very small city, but it was a very small city when I was growing up there in the 60s and the 70s. Canberra is kind of like the Washington, D.C. equivalent, except that it's a planned city. It really was only built from the sort of 1930s onwards. When I was growing up there, it only had about 200,000 people. It's quite a small city. And it's also in the middle, it's in the bush, you know, in the Australian bush. It's sometimes called the bush capital because it's got so many trees. So it was kind of like a country town, but then it had the weird extra layer of all the federal government stuff and also all the things like Washington, D.C. has on a smaller scale, like the National Library and the National Museum and Parliament House and all that sort of stuff as well. So it was an unusual city. It had a very, very good public education system then. It still does, perhaps not quite as good, which I benefited from, and a very good library system, which I also benefited from. And my parents are readers. Both my parents are science fiction and fantasy readers, amongst many other things. My father is a scientist and my mother is an artist. So from a very early age, I was exposed to all kinds of books. Our house was full of books. There was a library between my home and my school, which I stopped at every afternoon, a children's library, a specialist children's library. And I read everything. I mean, I love all kinds of books. I do love fantasy and science fiction, but I also love historical novels and thrillers and contemporary literature and, you know, classics, all kinds of stuff, and nonfiction as well. I've always been fascinated with all kinds of nonfiction. I noticed, Edward, that you've written a lot of nonfiction. Looking at your bio before I started to talk to you.
Anything for a buck, basically. Yeah.
Well, but also
I love that stuff. I love learning about things and writing about them.
And I think it's good for writers too. You need to read nonfiction as well as fiction to fill your mind with all kinds of information you can draw upon to create fiction. And nonfiction is very, very good fuel for that. So I was always reading. There were books everywhere. My parents read science fiction and fantasy. I probably had more than most people, in part because my father used to spend quite a lot of time in the US working for the US Department of Agriculture and the United Nations and a few other, you know, lots of international programs, some of which were run out of the US. One mysteriously always had to meet in Hawaii every year. I wonder why that was. But he would bring back American paperbacks, which we would not otherwise get. Because Australia, particularly in that period, most of the books came from the UK. So I was actually exposed to many American authors that not all Australians would necessarily have been and would not have been known in the UK. So I guess in a way, I had a perfect environment to become a writer of fantasy and science fiction because of that reading. And I was always very keen on making up stories. I've always loved making stuff up and trying to get people to believe it. And sometimes I joke that, you know, if I wasn't a writer, I'd probably be in jail as a confidence trickster because I like to make people believe in stuff. So I like to write stories that feel real. I like to tell stories that feel real. And there's not a big step, I think, from making up those kinds of fictions to some kind of complex scam, making people believe things. But luckily, I haven't gone down that road as yet. So, I'm sticking to the fiction.
So you started writing pretty young then, as a child?
Yeah, I did actually start. I loved the idea of my own books, and I made little books of my own from a very young age. In fact, I have one from when I was about six. Well, I actually do have one from when I'm about six. I don't take it with me. I have a sort of little replica that I bring with me. I use in talks sometimes to demonstrate how far I've come in my writing since I was 6 years old. At least I hope. I hope I have. So, yeah, I was making little books. I was writing stories. I wrote stories in school. But I didn't actually plan to be a writer. I loved books. I loved writing. But actually, right up until the end of high school, when I was thinking about what I am going to do, in the last few years, I was thinking I would actually join the regular Australian Army and go to our equivalent of West Point. But I actually joined the Army Reserve, and I was a part-time soldier for about 5 years. And that convinced me I didn't want to be a regular soldier. It was a very good experience. I really mostly enjoyed it with some reservations. But I also realized that the life that I would lead as a regular Army soldier would be more contained and closed. The environment would be more closed than if I did something else. So for quite a few, for a few years, I've been thinking that's what I would do. I would go to what was then the Australian Military College, and be an officer, and I learn and do a university degree and become a commissioned officer. But then I realized that, hang on, I actually don't want to do that. What am I going to do instead? And I got a job after I left school. I worked in a government job for a year, and I saved my money, and then I went traveling in the UK and Europe. And while I was doing that, I reread lots of my favorite books, particularly children's books and particularly English ones, and I read them in the places where they were set. So a lot of classic fantasy, like Alan Garner's The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, I read in, it's a fantastic book, in Cheshire. I read other children's classics like Arthur Ransom's Swallows and Amazons in the Lake District.
Thank you so much for mentioning that one.
Well, they're wonderful books. I mean, I still reread them. I mean, and if you, that also, I mean, that, those books made me interested in sailing.
Me too.
you get so much from those books. And then Rosemary Sutcliffe's The Eagle of the Ninth, historical novels, children's historical novels are also very much part of my reading. I read The Eagle of the Ninth while I was visiting Hadrian's Wall and so on. And while I was doing that, I also started to seriously write, whereas before I'd written stories off and on. And I wrote a couple of stories and sent them out. And I also started a novel. I wrote half a novel while I was traveling around. And, of course, this is back in the day. So I had a portable typewriter, a silver reed typewriter, and I would type away in the various places that I was staying, or actually often not in the places, the youth hostels I was staying, because it would annoy people. So I would actually go and type just by the side of the road or whatever, because I'd bought a little car, terrible old car that once the wheel literally did fall off, and it also caught a light once, but it also got me around about 10,000 miles of traveling. In the course of that time, I thought, I do want to be a writer. This is what I want to do. But I also, because I was a reader and I love nonfiction, one of the areas of nonfiction I read about was publishing and writers and writers' biographies. And even back then, I realized that a writer's life is generally very difficult and you need a day job. So, and I'm actually kind of astonished looking back that even at 19, I did have enough common sense to realize I would need a day job. I think, oh, that was probably one of the few areas where I had sufficient common sense, but I did. And so I made a plan to come back to Australia, go to university, get a degree, because that would enable me to get a better day job and also just to continue writing, which is pretty much what I did. And when I got back to Australia, I had a great encouragement, very early encouragement, because I got a telegram. This is shortly before telegrams were completely phased out. And in fact, I didn't even know they still existed at that point until I got one, which was from Penguin Books in the UK saying, we want to publish your story, Sam Cars and the Cuckoo, and we'll pay £90, prepaid telegram reply, you know, yes or no. And I hadn't even sent it to them. So I was extremely puzzled, but also very happy. And I unraveled this mystery many years later, because I'd sent the story to the gaming magazine White Dwarf. Oh, no, sorry. Yes, I'd sent it to the gaming magazine White Dwarf because I had a little bit of success writing gaming articles about Dungeons and Dragons and Traveller and so on. They at that point they did occasionally publish fiction. This is again a long way back. The magazine was very different, and so it was. I'd sent it to White Dwarf. So it was a great surprise to get this telegram from Penguin Books saying we want it for a magazine called Warlock. And anyway, as it transpired, I discovered much later an editor from White Dwarf had left to join Penguin to work on their magazine Warlock, which was for their fighting fantasy books, was in support of their fighting fantasy books. And he'd actually just taken the, I don't know, I guess the submission inventory from White Dwarf with him, including my story. And I met him years later and he said that he'd just taken his whole folder with him and bought some of the stuff for Warlock. But I thought, wow, this is fantastic. £90, this is in 1982, I think, was quite a lot of money, particularly in Australian dollars at the time. And I thought, wow, I can write a short story every couple of weeks and get this money and, it'll be brilliant. But of course, I couldn't actually sell a short story for about another 5 years after that. I think I wrote about 40 without being able to sell any of them. So, which is, again, of course, a very common experience. But at least I had the early encouragement of that first short story sale.
I reacted to the Arthur Ransom reference because they were books that were very important to me when I was growing up. And I spent my in Canada, we got a family allowance. So I think it was $10 a month per kid. And my parents gave that to me as my allowance. And I saved that up and bought all the Arthur Ransom books.
Great. Fantastic.
And in my last book before this, my current one is Master of the World, is book two in this series. But in the first one, World Shaper, there is an occasion in which they get onto a sailing yacht, and I name the yacht Amazon, and there's some reference in there. So I do try to reference those books when I can.
Yeah. Well, these things, they're saying, the books, your childhood books are so important for what you do later. And I think whether you even consciously reference them, they're there. They're deeply embedded in that, in the reservoir you call upon to write. So they're always present, and it's sometimes there's conscious references and sometimes there's conscious resonance and sometimes it's unconscious, but having read them is the necessary part of the equation.
Now, you got your BA in professional writing. What kind of a course was that? Is that a creative writing course or is it more of a journalism course, or what? I haven't seen that phrase before.
Yeah, well, it's very old. They don't actually offer that anymore. But at the time, that was the only writing degree offered in Australia. I mean, it's very, again, a very different time. Of course, everywhere offers, you know, creative writing or writing degrees now. But at the time, that the what was then the Canberra College of Advanced Education, it's now the University of Canberra. It was the only place in Australia that offered any kind of writing degree. And principally, it actually was a journalism school. And most people there were majoring in journalism. But they also had a screenwriting stream, which included a small element of prose writing or fiction writing. So when I was looking at what I could do, I wanted to get a degree mainly as a kind of, you know, ticket to show at door to get a better day job. But I thought, well, I might as well do a writing degree. And it was luckily in my home city, Canberra. So it was just much more doable in terms of, I could stay with my parents, and which I did most of the time. It was just logistically easy. So I was very lucky it was there. And it was actually a really good experience. I majored in screenwriting. And I guess it's like a lot of those writing degrees, in the sense that someone once said, you can't be taught writing, but you can learn. And really, I think the most valuable thing for me was that it set up an environment in which you're expected to do a lot of writing, and you were in the company of other people who were very keen to write. So I met some very good friends there, and I reconnected with some old friends who coincidentally just happened to be there. I had no idea, old school friends who also wanted to be writers. And being in the company of those people, and also having the workshop experience, which is the typical one of where you pass work around in a tutorial group or workshop group and discuss it, very much as many workshops do now. That was very valuable. To be honest, most of the actual lectures and so forth were not particularly useful, but being in an environment too where you need to create work all the time and has to be on time, and because they treated it like the journalism strain was very strong, it was treated as if it was a job at a newspaper. If you didn't file on time, you got zero. That was it. There was no, I'm sorry, I've been ill or whatever. It was just zero, because they said, this is what will happen at a newspaper. You have to, if you're told to write something, that's your job, you've got to write it. So that was all very, very useful. So it was a good 3 years. And I studied theatre there as well, and did some productions. I ended up directing a production of The Crucible in my last year, and it was fun, and it was a good experience. And I think I probably would have kept writing anyway, but it really did help shape some of the discipline to do that. And I wrote probably half my first published novel, The Ragwitch, while I was doing that course, for that course too. So that was also a good thing.
I'm interested in the theater experience. I've talked to a number of writers who have some theater experience, and I'm a theater guy myself. I've written plays, and I'm a professional actor, and I've directed and all that. And I always like to ask if you find that the theater experience helps you in your fiction writing. Orson Scott Card is one who says it does, and I just talked to James Allen Gardner, and he said it does. So what was your experience?
Well, I think it all helps, to be honest. I think all the cross-media stuff helps. The screenwriting experience is also very helpful. To be honest, I think everything helps. Experience of life helps. Reading books helps. Strange knowledge of rock formations might help. Anything can help. But particularly in terms of writing, I think experience of different ways to tell stories and convey stories to people, whether it's visually or orally or using different senses. And theatre in particular is often very good for experimental ways to communicate stories. People are always looking at different ways to stage and perform, and that makes you think about, well, hang on, maybe I could do something different. just on a page as well. So it was very useful. I directed a play. I performed in plays. I'm a terrible actor, but it was probably a useful experience, and useful for something that's very much part of a modern author's life, which is, of course, talking about your work, because we're all expected to do that nowadays and need to do that, whether it's in person at bookshop events or it's on YouTube or even in a podcast like this. I'm sure some of that early actor training, even though I was a terrible actor on stage or screen, it probably helps me play myself, as it were, and to get across what I want to get across. And it was just interesting. It was just a good thing to do. I also worked as a stagehand briefly after university as an additional job. I worked in a bookshop, but also I worked as a stagehand on a couple of different productions with a very good friend of mine, also a writer. And that was a really good experience too. I've not drawn upon directly for a story, but I think some of the conversations we had whilst working on that show and the sort of cynical realism of backstage people was exposure to characters that you might not otherwise have been exposed to, as with anything somewhat out of what you normally do, was very useful. Yeah, some of the old, literally old, as in they would have probably been in their 60s, people who worked in the theatre and had done for forever were such interesting characters and had some very interesting stories to tell. So things like that, I think everything's useful.
Yeah, theatre people have lots of interesting stories to tell if they've been in it for
absolutely
a while.
yeah.
Now, you mentioned The Ragwitch, which was your first published novel. When did that come about? You went on to work in publishing, but how did that all line up?
Well, as I said, I realized I would need a day job. And while I was at university and thinking about what I could do, I did actually think about journalism for a while. Many of my friends were journalists.
I did it.
it's a very sort of standard sort of thing. So I toyed with that, but I found that I didn't. Well, I could adequately write everything required. I could write whatever was required. I actually didn't particularly like having to stick to the facts, which is a bit of a drawback in journalism, or it should be a drawback. And so I was thinking, what else can I do? And I was still, fascinated with books and really interested in publishing. So I thought, okay, well, that's what I'll do. My day job will be publishing. And I was still, I was writing all the time. I can continue to write and that will sort of feed off each other. And one of the classic ways, and then looking around to see how I could do that, of course, one of the classic ways, and it's still one of the best ways to get into publishing, is to get a job in a bookshop. So that's what I did. And I worked in a wonderful bookshop where quite a number of my friends also worked in Canberra. And that then led to, I got a job as a sales representative for a very small publisher, which was in Sydney. So I moved to a much bigger city. But all the time I was writing, and at that time I was finishing The Ragwitch. So from that small publisher, which was a small trade publisher, I then moved to an academic press on the production side as an editorial assistant. And while I was there, and I was sort of worked my way up there to be an editor and then actually the publications manager there. But during that time, when I was at that academic publisher, I got The Ragwitch published. But in the usual way, I researched publishers. I looked at who was publishing that kind of novel. I submitted it to 7 publishers, most of whom rejected it. 2, I think, never replied at all. And then one day I came home and there was a message on my answering machine, again, back the old days, cassette answering machine, from a publisher saying, can you come and talk to us about it? And it was picked up and published in 1991, which is a long time ago.
But there's been several since then.
We're more than several, yes. Yes, I've managed to keep going, which is basically the whole secret, really, is, as I often say to people, the answer to any publishing problem is to write another book. You know, whether it's problems of success or of failure or things not working out as you would hope, you know, write another book. It gives you another chance.
I think it was
another spin of the wheel.
Yeah, I think it was maybe Stephen King that said, it's usually either Stephen King or Ray Bradbury who says these things.
Absolutely, yeah.
That the difference between a published writer and an unpublished writer is that the published writer didn't give up. So
they probably both said that in different ways, actually, and it's true. Though it can be extraordinarily difficult to keep going because of all kinds of factors. You know, I've been very fortunate across the board, really, in terms of who I am and my background and where I live, and even such things as you know, the fact that we have essentially free healthcare here in Australia makes a massive difference. I'm very well aware of many of my American friends who are successful authors, but they can't give up their day jobs to write more because they need the day job for the medical insurance. Mm. So there's those kinds of factors, and I've been very lucky.
Well, we're going to talk about your creative process, and we're going to focus on your latest, which is Angel Mage, which unfortunately I have not had a chance to read, but that's okay, because I'm going to get you to synopsize it for people who haven't read it, like me.
I'll just read it to you on the podcast, Edward. It's only going to take about 18 hours. That's all right, isn't it?
Yeah. No, sure. I'll just make it a multi-part podcast.
No, I wouldn't dare do that, because it's actually, the audio book has been read far, far, you know, far, far better. Anyway, I recently distilled the sort of elevator pitch for the book, even though I don't really believe in elevator pitches, but with the help of various people who've already reviewed it and commented about the book, the sort of simple summary is that it's the Three Musketeers crossed with Joan of Arc, crossed with angelic magic, crossed with kick-ass woman heroes. And that sums it up on a variety of levels. But yeah, Angel Mage is very much inspired by Alexandre Dumas's The Three Musketeers and the Richard Lester 1973-1974 films of The Three Musketeers and The Four Musketeers.
I love those movies too.
I mean, they're brilliant movies and brilliant adaptations of the book. Very much inspired by that, but it's not a retelling. Angel Mage is the story of Lilith, who is an angel mage. She is able to summon angels using icons that she makes. Lilith is perhaps the most preeminent angelic mage who's ever lived. Unfortunately, she has already destroyed one kingdom in an effort to do something, which is unclear, involving an archangel, the archangel of that kingdom. And this is all happens before the book begins. And she did something which caused a terrible plague that killed most people or turned them into monsters. She was thought to be killed by it as well, or to something have happened to her. But in fact, she wasn't. She just went into a long sleep to have another go. And the book is actually about her awakening from her long rest to try and put in motion once again and to successfully carry out whatever her plan is to get closer to her beloved archangel, Pelennial. And this is in the New Kingdom of Cerance, which is pretty much an analog of 17th century France, but with some important key differences. And to do so, Lilith needs to gather to her and direct four key individuals who are young people who are just embarking on their careers in the capital, Lutèce of Cerance, which is a sort of Paris equivalent. So she is setting up her plan again. She is manipulating these four characters who are brought together. I don't know why they, you know, what their connection is. They feel a connection, and they are Dorothea, who is also an angelic mage and a very gifted maker of icons. Simeon, who's a medical student at the hospital. Henri, who's a clerk of the cardinal. The cardinal is a woman, incidentally, and one of the, I guess, the key differences in Cerance is that you know, it's an equal opportunity kingdom as such, as most of my fantasy worlds are. Women can be all the things that, that men can be as well, as of course they can be in reality if they're not constrained by you know, social you know, barriers. Who have I forgotten? And Agnes, who's a musketeer, a cadet of the musketeers. And so it's a adventure story. It's set in the alternate 17th century, influenced by Dumas. And I hope it's just a great, enjoyable adventure that really takes you to another world, as World Shapers is all about. It, I hope it it takes readers to somewhere that feels real and they can go along for the ride.
Now, most of your books, and this one included, are classified as young adult. What has drawn you to the young adult side of the fiction writing spectrum?
Well, classifications are funny things. And in fact, Angel Mage is published as an adult fantasy in the UK and Australia.
And Amazon shows it as young adult. So.
Well, no, it is. Well, in America, it is published as young adult. It really, I guess, demonstrates the fluidity, particularly of young adult as a category. I guess what I would say is that the clue is all there in the name, young adult. It's young adult, not old children. So to my mind, you know, and it's confusing to people because YA covers such a broad range of books from very young YA, as it were, to older books. And, you know, categories in publishing are about publishers trying to find the sweet spot to connect core readers to a book. They always hope that the book will go beyond that core group. Now, you always hope that's just the kindling that starts the fire to reach everywhere, as it does with, you know, the really big best-selling books. They always go far wider than whatever their categorization is. But of course, to make that happen, you do need to connect with the people most likely to read the book, and that's partly about genre classification as well, which is why if you try and categorize a book as something that it doesn't really fit, which happens occasionally, where publishers want to try and position a book somewhere else, but it doesn't, for some, you know, readers are put off from it because it doesn't match their expectation. That's probably the cardinal problem. Cardinals in my mind, obviously, too many cardinals, is that's the biggest mistake you can make in publishing, because if you try and sell a book as something it isn't, you know, the people who would love it don't buy it, and the people who you're hoping to try and get to love it typically don't buy it either. So the safe method is always to try and connect to a core audience. And partly, of course, what happens is if you're known for a particular genre or category, if your book can even halfway fit into that category, that's where publishers will try and put it. In the case of Angel Mage, I'm absolutely fine with calling it a young adult book. I do think it's a young adult book, but at the same time, I think it's important to be aware that doesn't mean it isn't for older adults as well. And in fact, there's all the data shows that most of YA is in fact being read by 18 to 35 year olds anyway, and older. It's not actually being read by teenagers. Wow. Which is a whole nother discussion, because there's a whole discussion about how teenagers are actually being marginalized out of a genre that's, you know, out of a, not a genre, a category, which is meant to be for them. But so it's not as straightforward as it may seem. I just write the stories. I mean, going back to answer your question more directly, I write for myself. And I guess I write for myself as I am now and as I was at 20 or 15 or even a bit younger, where I would have read a book like Angel Mage with no problems whatsoever, in the same way I was reading completely adult titles with no problem whatsoever. But I do write children's fiction as well, and when I am writing the children's books, I'm really writing for myself as I was at 10 or 11 or 12. But again, you know, good children's books work for all ages as well. And they work for older readers as well. It's not the primary audience, but in my view, all the best children's books will also work for an adult reader, because there's just more to them. There'll be multiple layers of story and meaning which make them work. And a child reader who may not be as practiced or experienced will just take that top layer of story and meaning, and they will love it and be carried along by it. And later you can come back to it. They'll come back to it later maybe and get some more of the subtext and more of the other layers of story. And an adult reader, a sophisticated adult reader, will get all of that straight away. Getting the balance of all those things right is the difficult part, except that most writers, I think, do it by instinct. So I think if you start thinking about it, it won't work. But if you've equipped yourself by reading, lots and lots of the right books, and by the right books, actually, I just mean any books really, except that you probably should have read lots and lots of books in the area in which you want to work, as well as everything else. Then you'll have equipped your storytelling and writing instinct to be able to do that without having to think about it too greatly. And of course, then the editorial process helps as well.
I've kind of run into the classification thing myself with the aforementioned trilogy with the 15-year-old protagonist, was published by Daw Books, which does not have a young adult line. And so it was published in the adult market. And I got people who said, well, this is really a young adult book. And then there were young adult reviewers who said, well, this is too grown up a book, but it has a 15-year-old protagonist. So, yeah, the whole genre classification thing
Well, it's important not to get too hung up on it, I think. I mean, when people start thinking, oh, I can't read this because it's YA, or I can't read this because it's adult, or I'm not going to read this because it's science fiction and all science fiction is terrible, those preconceptions just cut you off from reading good books. I think it's very important to look at books on their own merits. The whole categorization, the labels that are put on books, are all about how to sell them. They're not actually about, what their qualities are, whether literary qualities or narrative qualities or whatever. They're labels to help you find a book, but they are not exclusive labels. So I do think it's very important for people to, if you're reading about a book that sounds interesting, it probably is interesting. Have a look at it. Read some pages. Don't think, oh, it sounds really interesting, but it's YA, so it's not for me, or it's children, so it's not for me, or, oh, dang, I didn't realize it was romance, so I'm not going to read it. Because it could be absolutely the best book for you to read. It could be a wonderful book to read just because of some selling labels on it. I think preconception of genre and category is just really narrows people's reading habits sometimes, though many people, of course, don't care, which is good.
So going back to Angel Mage, you talked about the elevator pitch, but that came after the fact. So how did the original seed for this all come together? And is that typical of the way that Angel Mage came together? Is that typical of the way that your stories generally germinate?
That's a good question. The way I typically develop story is that stories that I will have an idea for something, and often it's just about a character in a situation, and I really don't know anything about it. I know I have a, it's like having a still cut out of a section of film, and I can sort of look at it in my head and think, oh well, there's this person in this situation, and this is this appears to be the setting, but I really don't know any more than that, and then I will start writing something about that. And often these little fragments I don't end up using, but they just help me work out what the story is or what the story might be. And sometimes they become full-on prologues or opening chapters, which again I might not use, but it does help me set the scene and I work out, you know, who that character is and what part they play and if they're going to be the main character. And I also work out the feel of the setting, the sort of tone of the setting, even if I don't know many details. And after I've written a little section like that, typically I don't do anything on it for a while, maybe a few weeks, maybe a few months. And my subconscious is working on it. And every now and again, I might make a few notes about that particular idea. And if it is going to come to something, then at some point, the next thing I usually do is write an outline, which I won't actually follow. It's one of those Zen outlines. The act of doing the outline is more important than what's going to be, it's going to be used for. I will write an outline and then probably will write the beginning, which I may have already written, and I'll just rewrite it, or it will be something completely different. I'll get that first chapter or prologue and first chapter down, and I will then revise the outline again. And at that point, I will have something which I will think, oh, okay, that's going to be my next book, or is going to be the one I'm going to write after the one I'm writing now. And that's when I'll share it with my agent and so on and start talking about it being the next book. And I should say, sometimes when I'm writing these, I begin this process where I have a little idea and I write a little bit, it becomes a short story. And I will write it, and then usually within a few weeks, and it'll be complete in itself. And then I know, okay, well, that's done. That is a story. It's not going to be a novel. It's not going to be anything else. And then I'll try and do something with that story.
So once if you decide to go on and write a novel, what does your actual writing process look like? Do you write, 24 hours a day? Do you sit at a tree with parchment and quill? How does it work for you?
Well, I actually did. I wrote many of my earlier novels longhand first. So I would write a chapter in longhand, pen on paper, in my favorite black and red notebooks. So I'd write a chapter longhand, and then I would type it up on various computers over the years, and then I would print it out and I would correct the printout and take in those corrections to the electronic file, and then I would write the next chapter longhand and then just repeat the process. I stopped doing that probably about 15 years ago, except that I still do write some sections longhand first. So I still write difficult chapters.
What does writing longhand do for you or for your prose?
Well, it just seemed to be a good process. I mean, I think I started it because when I was traveling and I started writing, I could just write in my notebook wherever. And this is long before, laptops it was really the early days of personal computers. I mean, when I came back from that trip, I got a TRS-80. And then I got my first Mac maybe the year after, and when it was actually one of the very first Macs, the Mac 512K, which was a miraculous thing. I mean, what you see is what you get on the screen, and printing out was astonishing compared to what I'd been using. But yes, not at all portable. So I think it stemmed from that ability to write in a notebook wherever I was, and on that trip, and then later on another trip 10 years later in the early 90s, You know, I wrote, I mean, Sabriel, I wrote part of, I wrote chapters, you know, I wrote a chapter sitting on a Crusader castle in Syria, the wall of a Crusader castle in Syria. I wrote in a Roman amphitheater in Jordan and under a medieval bridge in Esfahan in Iran and, you know, in the Khyber Pass and so on. And so being able to write anywhere was, I think, what drove that. And I just got into the habit of it and it worked. But I think also writing longhand and then typing my longhand. And as I typed, I would correct as well. So it did give me an extra layer of revision, which wasn't just reading, a sort of tactile revision, not just looking at it on screen and going through. But that said, I always wrote short stories pretty much straight on screen, all my short fiction. And then, you know, later I did just start to write just, you know, on the computer. But I still write longhand. I still write notes longhand, and I will occasionally, if I'm having difficulty, I will take my notebook and pen and go and write a chapter, often somewhere outside, somewhere in the sort of natural environment, not just at my desk. So I mix it up.
And once you get to the end of the book the first time through, what does your revision process look like?
Well, I revise all the way through. Typically, what I do, in fact, is I've written chapter one. Before I write chapter two, I actually will revise chapter one. I will, in my writing session, say I finish writing chapter one on Monday, and I would have done minor revision at the time, just going backwards and forwards with every writing session. On Tuesday, I will read chapter one, revise it, and then write chapter two. And then when I come to write chapter three, I'll revise chapter one and chapter two before writing chapter three. So I'm constantly revising all the way through. But of course, what that means is chapter one will have been, say the book's got 40 chapters. As part of my normal process, chapter one will have been revised 40 times, but by the time I get to the end, but in chapter 40 will have been revised notionally once, but in actual fact, you know, at least two or three times. And then when I have a complete manuscript, I will go through it again, usually two or three times before it goes to the publisher, with a little bit, as much fallow time as possible between revisions, which in practice normally means only two or three days, because of just time constraints and needing to deliver it. But then I also typically don't look at it again until I get the edit back from, or I get the top level edit letter back from my editor. I won't look at it at all. So, you know, I'll normally have at least a month or 6 weeks of having totally forgotten about it, with luck, before it comes back again. And in that time, I'll be writing other things. I'm always writing something. And I usually am writing a couple of short stories or sometimes a screenplay at the same time as writing the novel. The novel will take 80% of the time, but I will spend 20% of the time working on other projects. And then once the novel is is off my plate temporarily, I'll be working on those other things. And of course, also starting the next one. So it's always there's always the shuffling of the short order cook type shuffling of things around on the stove.
Every once in a while, as a full-time freelancer, I remember the song from My Fair Lady where Eliza sings, "Words, words, words, I'm so sick of words."
Yes. Well, you do get sick of it, absolutely. You occasionally do get sick of words like Eliza. But and when that happens, it's time to do something else for a while. Yeah, go for a walk or watch a movie or you know, anything that refills the – Or perhaps leeches the chamber of loathing for words.
What you mentioned the editorial letter that comes back. What sorts of things do you usually find yourself having to work on when the editor gets a look at them?
Well, it varies very much from book to book. I guess I've always felt greatly complimented by editors who tell me that my books don't need much revision. And they usually credit that to the fact that I do a lot of revision myself, and I do pride myself on delivering a very as clean and as revised, you know, manuscript's been revised as possible. So it varies from book to book. Usually there are things like tightening up particular sections, which may, the pace may have dragged, or very occasionally one famous editorial letter pointed out that I had a character who could be completely deleted from the book without making any difference whatsoever, and therefore should be, and of course, as always, your initial reaction is, oh, ridiculous nonsense. What are they talking about? And then after calm reflection and looking at the examples cited, I realized that, yes, that character was, in fact, completely extraneous and did absolutely nothing. And so I did get rid of them, and the book was all the better for it. So occasionally there's things like that. But generally speaking, they're mostly fine-tuning things, but not always. This is going a long way back. I benefited greatly from the editorial advice from my then editor, Ginny So, who was at HarperCollins, because I delivered Lyrael and Abhorson actually as one giant book. And that's how I wrote it, as one very large book. And she pointed out that it probably needed to be two. And it wasn't just a matter of cutting it in half. I actually needed to expand upon some aspects of Lyrael's earlier life, which I'd alluded to without going into. And so I took the book apart. I broke it in two, and I rewrote both halves, adding and subtracting. And so that was quite a big task, but it was the right advice. It was very, very useful. So, yeah, every now and again, there's big things and the small things.
I always like to talk about what the editors contribute, because there are, beginning writers or wannabe writers who are scared that editors will somehow, destroy their precious prose or something. And in my experience, they almost always make it better.
Almost always, but of course,
Not always.
You almost always, because you can unfortunately get bad editors who just don't understand the book, or who want to remake it into something that it's not. That does occasionally happen, but of course you deal with that. I've actually been very lucky. I've not had that really at all myself ever. But I was an editor, and I did. Well, I don't think I'm guilty of doing this myself either. I did work with many other editors, and I do know of, and I also, just from being in this business for a long time and knowing lots of other authors, I do know of a very few examples where just the wrong editor was working on a book with someone, and it was not a good fit. But that, as you say, that is not the norm at all. Usually, good editors are very helpful and make a big difference.
Well, we're close to the end of the time here, so I want to move on to the big, I always do this with my voice, the big philosophical questions, which is...
Well, I've got to go, but sorry, time. No, hit me with a question.
It's only one, really.
Good, okay.
With multiple parts, but why do you write? Why do you write stories of the fantastic specifically? And on a slightly broader level, why do you think anybody writes? Why do we tell stories? Stories, and why does anybody tell stories?
That is quite a tough question. Why do I write? Why do I tell stories? I think it's because I have to, on one level. I've always told stories. I've always had them bubbling up inside me, and I feel like they need to come out, I guess. I did allude to this earlier when I said that possibly if I didn't write stories, I'd be in jail as a confidence trickster, because I do have all these stories in me, and I have to get them out. Maybe this is how I make sense of the world, is by telling stories and by writing, or make sense of my world. But I do derive an enormous satisfaction when a story works out. I love it when I can successfully tell a story. And I should say nothing is ever as good as it is in my head. When I'm thinking up a story, it's always truly amazing. And then when I write it, it goes from truly amazing to, if I'm lucky, kind of amazing. And I look at it and I think, wow, that's great. I would like to read, if I came to this as a reader, I would like to read this. I would love this. And that's what I'm always trying to aim for. So I think it is that innate desire to tell stories just coming up inside me. Also matched with that, the satisfaction of telling a good story, and of making people make people happy isn't perhaps not quite the right description, because in fact the stories might not make people happy. They might make them feel all kinds of different things. But successfully transmitting a story from my head into a reader's via the medium of text, I guess, is something that gives me great satisfaction. As to why I write mostly fantastical stuff, that is also quite a tricky question. And possibly the best way to answer it is to say that whenever I do try to write something that is contemporary and entirely realistic in terms of our contemporary world, it hardly ever works out. The story may work out perfectly well, but it will end up having some element of the fantastic, even a very slight one. It just seems to be something I do, whether I plan to or not. I have set out to write entirely contemporary or historical stories, and nearly always some element of the fantastic. I just suddenly get part of the way through and I think, this would be so much better if the supernatural intrudes, or there's magic, or wouldn't this be more interesting if that person is not in fact a human? It just seems to be something again inside me that introduces these things. I have occasionally written things that do not have elements of the fantastic, but my natural bent seems to be to want to include them.
And that sounds very familiar to me, because that's exactly what happens.
Yeah, I think it's very absolutely. I think it's quite a shared trait of most fantasy writers, but not all, of course, because everyone is different, and there's so many different ways to write and write novels, and that's also part of the fascination.
And the idea of having the amazing image in your head and then trying to get it. I've sometimes used the image of, it's like you have a Christmas tree ornament and it's beautiful and perfect and you can see it so clearly, and then you smash it with a hammer and try to glue it back together with words.
Yes.
And give it to somebody.
Yes. Yes. And they might still be very impressed, but it's not quite what you wanted to give them.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So what are you working on now?
Well, I've actually just finished my next book, which is kind of ahead of schedule for me for once, which is good. And I'm just revising it at the moment. I'm revising it in response to the editorial letter at the moment. And that book is called The Left-Handed Booksellers of London. Mm-hmm. And it's set in 1983 in a slightly alternative London with a United Kingdom with a slightly different 20th century history. And it's about a young woman, Susan, who comes to London. She's an art student who will be starting art school later, but she's come early to London to try and find her father, who she doesn't know anything about. She just has some clues from her mother to follow up her very vague mother. And she almost instantly falls in with one of the left-handed booksellers called Merlin, who saves her from, well, they save each other, actually, from an intrusion of the mythic. And Susan is drawn to this world where the left-handed booksellers and the right-handed booksellers are a kind of secret organization that not only run a couple of bookshops, but also work to keep the mythic and legendary elements of Britain under control and stop them from intruding disastrously into the contemporary world. And Susan's quest to discover her father is connected very much with Merlin. Merlin also has a quest to try and find out what happened to his mother, who was apparently killed by criminals, but there seems to be some connection with the mythic world as well. So that's the Left-Handed Booksellers of London, which will be out hopefully this time next year.
No. And anything else that you're currently in process on?
I've got some short stories. I've actually got a bunch of stories coming out in different venues over the next 12 months. I had quite a little short story writing frenzy earlier this year. So I think I've got 5 stories coming out in various places over the next 12 months or so, which range from science fiction to fantasy, or different kinds of fantasy. Well, actually, one horror, one is just straight out horror, which I don't write that often, but every now and again, and some fantasy stories and science fiction. And I'm also outlining a new novel and notes for other stories, and I'm working on a screenplay with a friend of mine as well, who's a very high, very experienced and has had many things produced. Screenwriter, so lots and lots of things on that stovetop, as I mentioned before. I'm shuffling those pans around.
And where can people find you online?
They can find me at garthnix.com. On Facebook, it's just Facebook Garth Nix, and Garth Nix Author. I actually have my very old personal Facebook, which I always just use to connect with readers, but it's generally full up with the 5,000 friend limit. And then later I started the author page, which is just the Garth Nix one. So Facebook, I'm there. But actually where I'm most likely to respond to people, and I'm much more likely to post, in fact, is Twitter, where I'm also just at Garth Nix on Twitter. And if you want to ask me a question, Twitter is generally the place where I'm most likely to be able to respond in a sort of timely fashion, far more than anywhere else.
Alrighty. Well, thanks so much for being a guest on the World Shapers, Garth. I really appreciate it.
Good. Thank you. It's always fun to talk about writing, isn't it? Writing and publishing.
That's why I started the podcast. So.
Yeah, very good.
Right. Well, bye for now.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
So thanks again to Garth Nix for being a guest on The World Shapers. That was a great conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Just a reminder that you can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com. You can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers. And you can find it on Facebook if you look up The World Shapers. You can find me online at edwardwillett.com, edwardwillett.com. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett, and you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/edwardwillett. That's it for this episode of The World Shapers. Coming up, our next 3 episodes will be Rebecca Roanhorse, Mary Robinette Cole, and Candace Jane Dorsey. And I have lots of more great guests lined up for the weeks following that. So please do come back and check them out. And be sure to check out all of the previous episodes. The aforementioned website, theworldshapers.com, includes an archive page with a handy list of all of them. So just click on the one that interests you and away you go. Once again, I must say that this podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, supported by Kinexis Credit Union. Kinexis Credit Union is all about their members. Improving their financial well-being drives everything they do. And that's not just something they say. It's a promise that's delivered by over 900 employees across Saskatchewan. Their employees are members too, and they've been there, so they're committed to making your money work for you. The banking industry needs to change, and Kinexys is changing it for everyone, because Kinexys cares. Visit kinexys.ca to learn more. So that brings us to the end of this episode of The World Shapers. I will be back in a couple of weeks with the next episode featuring Rebecca Roanhorse. And as I said, wonderful guests lined up, or tentatively lined up, going into the next year. So come back and listen to more great conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the worlds they've created and the characters that live within them that we enjoy reading about so much. That's it for this episode. Bye for now.